From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we explore the history of how Sherman Park became such a diverse place.
Then an award-winning photographer and former Wisconsinite trains his lens on Vietnam.
Vietnam has a population of which 50% is under the age of 30. And this is the world's 13th largest country with 100 million people. So that is a lot of youth, a lot of energy, a lot of excitement.
On Fit for You, we learn why the exercise program called TRX is gaining fans.
I really feel, and I truly believe, that TRX and weight training, regular traditional free weights, is a really good marriage.
And Radio Chipstone visits an exhibit of fashion by an influential Milwaukee children's clothing designer. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Lake Effect Mayan Silver has been reporting this week for us and for WUWM News on diversity in Sherman Park. Yesterday, she introduced us to two adjacent businesses, a barbershop catering to mainly African-American customers, and the kosher butcher and deli next door.
During Morning Edition today, Mayan reported just what led Sherman Park to become the diverse place it is today. We continue that exploration on Lake Effect with historian John Gerda, who explained to her how these two vastly different traditions ended up sharing a neighborhood.
Starting with the Jewish community, for the Eastern European Jews, the foothold in Milwaukee was the Haymarket area, which is right around the Hillside Terrace housing project, around between 12th and 3rd, and maybe Juneau up to about Walnut, that section. And they began there back in the 1880s, and that had been a German neighborhood, and the vectors in Milwaukee are really obvious, and they are in most cities. You kind of begin at the heart of town and move out in very predictable directions. So the Germans moved north and west as they advanced economically, and the Jews followed them. So their foothold is the 1880s. By the turn of the 20th century, they are moving not far, but up to maybe North Avenue. Teens and 20s is when they really began to move in that direction in large numbers. And then the major movement was through the decade of the 1920s out to Sherman Park. And that's the area between 31st and 60th and North Avenue and Capitol Drive and Center Street and Burleigh. Became their main corridors. There were Jewish businesses there, everyone from Guten's Deli to the Sanitary Kosher Market to New Method Hebrew School. And interestingly, although a lot of the people moved out there, the synagogues did not follow largely until after World War II. So you have the war ends in 45, and in the next 15 years, you've got six synagogues locating in the Sherman Park neighborhood, largely on Center and Burleigh. There had been one a little earlier, but it was not quite in Sherman Park. It was Bethel, which was down in Washington Heights. That goes back to 1923. And that was the first synagogue in Milwaukee, west of 13th Street. So that's kind of where the movement was. So you have a very mixed population. So there were a lot of Germans out there, some Irish, a variety of other European groups. But Jews were, because they had all the institutions, a very visible component of that population. The African-American population was the identical story. They begin even earlier in Milwaukee. They go back to the 1830s. By 1850, there were probably 100 African-Americans in Milwaukee. And in time, their neighborhood became right around the old Haymarket, the old Jewish quarter back west of Schlitz Brewery. And the area a bit north, 3rd Street, the Bronzeville section, 3rd, Walnut, up North Avenue, that becomes their commercial heart. And just like the Germans first and then the Jews, the African-Americans moved north and west on those same vectors, Fond du Lac Avenue, Titonia, Lisbon. And by the 1970s, is when they were a significant presence in Sherman Park. I think in 1980, they were about 26% of Sherman Park's population. So that was kind of a critical mass. And for all three groups, the motivation was the same. You are moving out as you are moving up, looking for a better quality of life for your families.
And why is it that the better quality of life is out? Why was it that, for instance, the Germans originally moved out there and then the Jews followed and then African Americans? Like, what was better about those areas?
Sort of the American way. Kind of every generation has an expectation of doing better than its parents. And especially for immigrants, you know, their kids, were the ones who were living the American dream, where their parents were kind of living in both worlds in a lot of ways. So, for instance, on the north side, those houses in the Haymarket area, they weren't a whole lot to begin with, and they had not improved with age. So there was a very obvious increase in the standard of living as you moved out to new homes. It's the same thing that motivated people after World War II to move to the suburbs all across the country. Your place of your own, new house, new appliances, it's kind of the American dream of advancement. And that was true for all the groups.
I see. Was the school a major draw in the Sherman Park area?
It was among the major draws. Washington High School opens back in 1915 on Sherman Boulevard. So it was a new school, kind of waiting for, critical mass of population. And that became widely considered the best high school in Milwaukee. So that became a magnet, but it was by no means the only one. It was this much more generalized pattern of moving out as you move up. Education was part of that, but so was housing, so were businesses, so were the yards. So it was kind of a complex of all those factors.
And were there better jobs out in, like, further out areas like Sherman Park?
No, it was not so much economically driven. By the time Sherman Park really experiences great growth in the 1920s, Milwaukee, like most U.S. cities, had made the transition to a very automobile-oriented culture. Streetcars were still really important, and there were good lines kind of going out in that direction. But a lot of people who built those houses in Sherman Park back in the 1920s were commuting back to work the north side or downtown. In the case of the Jewish population, merchants, professionals, people who were largely white-collar. There were some blue-collar workers, but not as many. For African Americans, there were a lot of industrial jobs along the 30th Street Industrial Corridor that runs from Miller Brewing down there in Highland all the way up to past A.O. Smith on Capitol Drive. So there were lots and lots of jobs there. And that was also a draw, just as education was. But again, it was that far more generalized pattern of migration out from an old and somewhat weather-beaten part of town out to something new.
And was it the Germans who built those houses out in Sherman Park?
Initially, they were the largest group, but it was kind of mixed European back in the 20s, and Jewish families as well built those homes. So a lot of those were, that was the first pile of sticks on any of those lots. There were those families who moved out there and built back in the 20s.
And why was it that maybe parts of Sherman Park have deteriorated as time has gone on?
Part of the same pattern. You have deterioration of the very heart of the inner city. Partly it's a function of the age of homes. A greater part is a function of income, and that is related to a higher proportion of renter-occupied homes and owner-occupied homes. Landlords, not being as diligent about upkeep as, you would hope them to be. So it's been a complex of sort of the physical issues, and what drives a lot of that is the deindustrialization of a lot of Milwaukee, places like the 30th Street Industrial Corridor, beginning in the 1980s. That was when things really began to change, and that's national. It's not just Milwaukee. We lost about a quarter of our manufacturing jobs between 79 and 83, and a lot of those were held by African Americans. So it was Milwaukee, relatively speaking, suffered a less severe loss of jobs than other cities, but still it was certainly characterized as catastrophic. So, without means to keep those houses in good shape, they began to deteriorate even faster. So it was kind of a blend of age and income.
And how has the Jewish community been able to upkeep their homes and that type of thing?
The Orthodox community there, and that's the other pattern. By the 1970s, you have a lot of movement of the original Jewish residents, their descendants by that time, and their congregations, in large part to the area east of the Milwaukee River, so the North Shore especially. And it's really interesting if you follow the patterns. The first synagogue row in Milwaukee was around Cherry Street, between 3rd and 6th. And the next one out was Center Street in Burleigh, between roughly 31st and 60th. And the next one out was Mequon Road, west of Fort Washington Road. So you have this very interesting kind of migration. So there was a movement out of the Orthodox congregations, many of whom became conservative, and the last one remaining there was Beth Yehuda. And one of the real attractions for the people of Beth Yehuda was this wonderful housing stock. You've got these great land and stone, brick, period revivals, these great bungalows from the 20s. And as the area, it was kind of a mixed blessing, but as the area lost some of its economic power, those houses were really reasonably priced. So you could get a great house in Sherman Park, a great yard. And these were homes that had been, for the most part, pretty well maintained from the time they were built back in the 1920s, in some cases the 1930s. So how they were able to preserve that neighborhood was simply to maintain standards that were already there.
And when the Jewish population was there over the decades, did it tend to be an Orthodox Jewish population, or was it a mixed Orthodox secular?
It was largely Orthodox, but what was going on in American society and in American Judaism was kind of this movement away from the strictures of more traditional religions. So a lot of congregations that had been Orthodox became conservative. At the same time, there was a movement away among Jews as among Catholics and Protestants in all those neighborhoods. Away from strict observance and toward a more secular interpretation of society. So those things were going on at the same time, kind of the loosening of traditional ties to orthodoxy in the Jews' case and the more secularization of American society that really became a tidal wave after World War II.
Did the Jewish population mainly attend, did the kids mostly attend Washington High School and the public schools, or were there private Jewish schools?
The Jewish schools were largely value-added. No, there weren't any, until the Yeshiva Elementary School opened by Beth Yehuda. I don't believe there was a full-time school. Beth Israel had one on Titonia back in the 1920s. But for the most part, it was the synagogue's role, and the families, obviously, to make sure there was education about tradition, both cultural and religious. But the main education was done in the public schools.
As far as the status today of the two communities that are living there along with any other communities that are inhabiting Sherman Park, do you think that there's things and lessons we can learn from that, or trends or anything like that?
One of the lessons of Sherman Park, that's been for the last at least generation and more, for going on 50 years at this point, an experiment in diversity. And there still is very impressive diversity there, but I think in 2010, the African-American population was roughly 83% of Sherman Park's population. So it's become, obviously, very much a majority black neighborhood. There are other groups there, including Gentile preservationists who just love those old bungalows and period revival homes. But Beth Yehuda, the Orthodox community there, is something of a village inside the city, and I think that's how they see themselves as well. And they've been, certainly they are a community that, has its own very strong sense of internal solidarity, but they've also been involved in the area, in and surrounding their community. So I guess if there's a lesson there, the two lessons would be how hard it is to maintain in American society a true diversity for the long term. And another lesson would be that in the case of Sherman Park, you really do have, in this case, Orthodox Jews and African Americans living side by side, generally speaking, in harmony, symbiosis.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and author of numerous books, including The Making of Milwaukee and Cream City Chronicles. He spoke with Mayon Silver, and you can see pictures and hear all the parts of her series on Sherman Park, including her pieces for Morning Edition, at WUWM.com.
We travel to Vietnam next to learn about the unique story of a book of photographs by a former Wisconsinite. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Larry DiTillo has done a little bit of everything. He's been a classical musician, an aviator, and most useful to our next segment, an award-winning photographer.
The former Milwaukee area resident now splits his time between Los Angeles and Hanoi, Vietnam. And it's in that country that his most recent project played out. The Soul of Vietnam, A Portrait of the North, is a collection of photographs that was commissioned by the government of Vietnam.
Last June, DiTillo was back in Milwaukee to raise money for printing and distribution costs. Well, those efforts were successful, and tomorrow night he'll talk about the now completed book at Boswell Book Company. Here's a listen back to our conversation from a year ago. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be back in Milwaukee.
Before you tell me about this book, let's back up. I think the last time you were here, it was about 7 years ago, and you had started your Vietnam adventure. I want to say it's an adventure because you're both living there part of the time, but you were going to take photographs. And we talked about that and what you were doing. And now you're back with a book of photographs.
That's an interesting coincidence because it was about that time that the idea for this book called The Soul of Vietnam was first really considered. And it was an interesting time because up to that point, most of my work had been in the city of Hanoi, and we had already done some major exhibits at their National Museum. And we had become very involved also with supporting 1,600 poor rural women with a microloan program that was, among other things, helped by funding from the Elmbrook Rotary Club here in the Milwaukee area. So it was a very interesting crossroads time for us. And I'm happy that we got going on this book because it did take 7 years for me to get to the point where I was really completely at ease with the quality that was involved.
How did Vietnam come to have this hold on you in the first place? Why did you want to go and even think about producing a book of photographs?
I don't think we really, at the beginning, which was in 2006, we were invited to Vietnam to work with Vietnamese contemporary artists on collaborative projects. So as an artist, that was certainly an interesting challenge and well worth accepting. We had no idea after those first 3 months that we would continue that relationship. But we were so overwhelmed by, let's see, a list here. Of course, so many Americans already know Vietnamese food is absolutely fantastic and incredibly healthy. So that was a big asset. We love the sheer excitement that Vietnam has because Vietnam has a population of which 50% is under the age of 30. And this is the world's 13th largest country with 100 million people. So that is a lot of youth, a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. And finally, it was a place in which optimism seems to prevail. And that fits certainly the kind of personality I think of myself as being.
I find it interesting that you use the word optimism, particularly given Vietnam's most recent history. Not only our own involvement, but as we were saying, while we were waiting for the studio, there was a war with China, too. And they've had some pretty difficult times in the last half century.
The best way to understand that is from their point of view rather than ours. Because they say, yes, it was very difficult, and yes, millions of people died in the war with the U.S. And in a much briefer period, they also lost, I think, 700,000 people in the war with China, which was in 1979. But they say in both those situations, those are kind of blips on their very, very long 11,000-year-old history. They say these things come and go, and you survive them, and you move on, and there's no point dwelling on them. And so they hold nothing against us. They're enormously friendly with the U.S. They don't need to forgive. They just say, well, stuff happens, you know, and you get through it and you move on. It's an amazing attitude.
The pictures in the book are also amazing. And one of the things that I think Vietnam has, in addition to the food and the people, is they have this amazing landscape. Landscapes, I should say, because there are many in that not very big country.
That's also an incredibly attractive thing about Vietnam, that they have mountains almost up to 14,000 feet. They have deserts. They have a seaside resort-like beaches that go on as long as it would be from Vancouver, Washington, all the way down to Baja, California. There's so much of it, and it's so beautiful. These rocky, incredibly beautiful coastlines. And of course, now there are a great many very modern, very hip resorts along that way. So I think that we could say that along with those things, they have jungles, of course, extensive jungle. They have great deltas from their rivers. It's just about everything imaginable. The way I think about it is I think about the variety that exists in California, which fits that same description. And I would say Vietnam is probably equal to California in that regard, of the sheer beauty that's there.
And the biodiversity
there. Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking the only thing that they probably don't have are glaciers.
No, you know, a little too warm for that.
A little too warm for that.
Because it really doesn't get to freezing even in the northern part of the country, although very occasionally in the high mountains that lie along the border with China, there will be an occasional dusting of snow. And that sometimes causes some issues because they're not used to it. But I should point out, Bonnie, that one of the really interesting things is the Wisconsin's relationship to Vietnam. It's fairly extensive. There's a number of Wisconsin people who have been heavily involved in Vietnam and various nonprofit type programs, including the Children's Library Program run by Chuck Touche, who's originally from here and works from an office in Chicago. But Chuck has built over 35 libraries across the rural landscape of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
And there's also quite a population of Vietnamese people here, just in Milwaukee, but I think probably in southeastern Wisconsin in general.
Yeah, it is interesting because when the Chinese New Year comes along, Tet, which is observed by the Vietnamese community, there's really a lot of people show up for a lot of really big shindigs that are going on here in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee is not certainly one of the top 10 in terms of population of people of Vietnamese derivation. By the way, the proper term for that is called Viet Kieu, which means a Vietnamese who's become essentially an expat, an expatriate. But the largest deposits, of course, of those folks are those families are in San Francisco, in that general area, Silicon Valley, the second one in L.A., the third is Houston, and the fourth is Minneapolis. What is really interesting is that right now, excluding people of African descent, but including people of Latino descent, the Vietnamese in the United States are now the second largest ethnic group.
And you mentioned L.A. Now, that is one of your homes. The other home, of course, is in Hanoi, and you spend time going back and forth. How different are they and how similar?
Well, the difference, of course, is really cultural. America is a truly remarkable country, unlike anyone else. And most other countries would say this is one of the great things about America, is the cultural diversity. We have people living in our country who have been here for a generation or have been born here and come from that type of a family that represent just about every nationality, every ethnic group, everything that ever existed in the world is sitting here in the United States. And a heck of a lot of that is in Los Angeles and then also in New York City. So that really changes the dynamic of the meaning of the U.S. to a very large worldly picture, in my opinion. And the other countries are dominantly essentially a single culture that's been there for a long time. In the Vietnamese case, the Viet, which is the dominant population, has been there for more than 1,000 years. But their original ethnic groups, of which there are 54 of them, including the Hmong, whom you're familiar with, they have been there for 5 to 11,000 years. So there's a mixture of both the Viet, the dominant culture, as well as the ethnic cultures. That means a little bit of diversity, but not very much. So that's a giant difference because when you have those kinds of old cultures, they continue to do a lot of things and believe a lot of things based on those cultural backgrounds. Here in the United States, we really don't have much of that to talk about. And so we tend to be very much into the kind of the present and the future. And we're not really held back as much by historical context. On the other hand, when it comes to similarities, especially Hanoi, has a kind of the enthusiasm and the amazing amount of creative energy in it that we also see in Los Angeles today.
Well, now that you have the book, talk a little bit about the publisher, because this is actually the government of Vietnam, right, that is publishing this?
In essence, yes. The publisher, the name of the publisher is called Thế Giới. What was interesting about this is that I discovered after they expressed an interest in being the publisher that all of the printers are essentially owned, not the publishers, the printers are essentially owned in part or in whole by the government. So they, you know, that kind of comes back to the typical kind of centralized control thing that typifies the past in Vietnam. However, the cool thing about this is that from an American viewpoint, I grew up in a time in which everything about communism was, how should we say, I thought about it in a very negative way. But my firsthand experience on more than one occasion working with people in the party is that they're actually very negotiable and they listen well and they're very compromising. They're not difficult to deal with, at least in Vietnam. I can't speak for countries like, obviously, North Korea and Cuba. That's a whole other ballgame, China. But the Vietnamese, the basic culture, seems to supersede whatever their political thoughts are, which makes them gentle, caring, and easy to work with.
Larry, it is always great to see you. I hope you will stop back the next time you are visiting. And best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Bonnie. It's always a pleasure being here on Lake Effect.
Award-winning photographer and former Milwaukeean Larry DiTilio's latest project is a book called The Soul of Vietnam, A Portrait of the North. He'll talk about it at Boswell Book Company tomorrow evening. There's a link to more information at WUWM.com.
We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, our Fit for You segment takes a look at the phenomenon known as TRX. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. If you've ever worked out at a gym, maybe you've noticed some floor space that remains clear except for some straps suspended from the ceiling, a frame, or even attached to the wall. These yellow and gold straps with handles are called TRX straps. And although they're simple in appearance, they can be intimidating or even confusing as to what to do with them without some prior knowledge.
To find out more about TRX, Audrey Nowakowski visited personal trainer and group exercise instructor Kathy Quadracci at a Milwaukee gym.
So, Kathy, we are standing in the middle of the WAC North Shore, kind of underneath this big towering A-frame structure. Metal bars and lots of random straps hanging from it. So, first of all, can you explain to our listeners what TRX straps look like, and then who created them? How are they developed?
Okay, so the TRX straps are, well, they're yellow and black if you see them hanging out. And what it is, it's nylon, and they're secured to this A-frame, and it's just two individual straps with handles on the bottom, handles at the bottom. They are adjustable for the different exercises you need. And that's pretty much it. They're just straps that kind of hang down with the handle.
So very simple, but maybe for someone who doesn't know what to do with it.
Correct.
Could be intimidating.
Absolutely. It's very intimidating. People look at it and say, oh my God, I don't even know what to do with those straps. And they're so easy. They're for beginners all the way to professional athletes. Anybody can use them. But how TRX got started was it was created by a guy named Randy Hetrick, who was a U.S. Navy SEAL. And he was basically holed up in this compound waiting for his orders, and he knew he had to maintain his shape and form. So he came up with this, like he did a loop with his belt and kind of was playing with it, and then he went on to graduate school. This was his graduate project, and lo and behold, several years later, he's, you know, a $50 million company. So that's kind of how TRX started. It came up by a Navy SEAL. Okay. Navy SEAL invented it.
Yeah, so I imagine we think of Navy SEALs, they are the elite in everything that they do, including physical form. So if he needed one tool to stay that in shape in the desert, I imagine this is really versatile despite only being two straps hanging from
something. It is, because the whole premise of TRX is it uses your own body weight. It's very versatile, you can take it anywhere, it's very portable, it weighs less than 2 pounds. So it can easily, you can travel with it. I take mine on vacation, it comes with an anchor, you can throw it over the door, and you can do upper body, lower body, core, you can do everything that you want with these straps. It's actually pretty amazing. It's an amazing gizmo.
As you mentioned before, people can get really intimidated just by looking at this, especially if they don't know how to approach it. But are these easily able to modify exercises for people who maybe don't have the greatest mobility or flexibility or aren't ready to use their full body strength?
I really like TRX in the fact that, especially with people who are not used to doing squats or lunges, they're a great way for somebody to hang on to. It's something for someone to hang on to that's not stationary to the wall, but it can teach them proper form for squats and lunges. And you can go just down a little bit or move off to the side. We have somebody who's 80 years old all the way down to my son who's 13 years old who uses them.
This, in addition, is a type of suspension training, so to speak.
Yes.
So not only do you use your body weight, but I imagine there's a lot of work with balance and flexibility and maybe awakening some muscles that people don't normally use when doing this. So what are the benefits of using these straps for suspension training that other typical exercises say, you know, we're on a weight floor right now? What does this do that lifting weights won't?
So this, you have to always be balanced. For 99% of the exercises, it is all stability because these are not anchored except for to this A-frame. Everything else, your body is doing all the work. So even if you're doing a squat, you're stabilizing yourself with that squat. Or if you're doing a bicep curl, you are in a plank position, upright, but you're still engaging that core to maintain the stabilization for that move. And it's a complete circuit. So let's say you're doing a row, which is an upper body move. Your feet are planted, so your feet are working to hold you in place, and then your upper body is working because you're doing the row, then your also core is engaged to keep that balance and stability. So it's your entire body. TRX stands for total body resistance training, and it is. Your body is fully engaged when you're doing it.
Now, the core benefits are evident in that balance training. Is there cardio and multiple strengths for, you know, total body engagement? So you're using more than one section of your muscles. Say if I were to go on that bicep curl machine, I'm only using that section, but if I'm doing it here, it's all body. So is this also a cardiovascular workout when you get into it, or is it more about muscle endurance and strength?
It's, you know what, it's a little bit of both. It all depends on the workout. You can really do those bicep curls fast. And if you're just doing a standing bicep curl, you can do them fast and that will increase the heart rate because your muscles, you're not sitting down, you're standing. So your muscles are engaged just a little bit by the speed. You can do it by the intensity of the workout. You can angle your body more, and then the more body weight you pull up, the more you're engaged, the more that heart rate goes up. So it is a cardiovascular workout as well. It doesn't seem like it is, but it definitely gets that heart rate up.
Okay.
Yes.
So we've walked through just the overall concept of it, and we know there's two straps, but there are also multiple ways to get in and out of them or to utilize that. So walk me through, you mentioned upper body, you grip with your arms, but how do we get, you know, the leg holding variations and things like that? What is all possible with these two straps?
Okay, so with these two straps, you can hang on to the handles. And if you want to do lower body, you can hang on to the straps. You can lift one leg up and you can just do one single leg squat by still having that security of the straps holding you, or have something to hang on to. So that's one way to use the straps. How you get in the straps, like if you want to do a single leg lunge, that you're going to face away from the straps. So you're going to face away from that A-frame. I always grab both handles in the right hand if I'm going to put my left foot in, and I'm going to cross the left foot behind me and put one foot in both straps. That gives you more stability on your foot. Makes sense.
Yeah, so kind of like a reverse stirrup in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah, but they don't like to call them stirrups.
Reverse TRX.
Yeah. Reverse handles, yeah. Reverse stirrups, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So that is one way. It's kind of hard to describe.
I mean, we are trying to describe it over the radio,
right,
you know, versus, you know, this is right in front of us, so we can see that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to explain to our listeners who maybe want to look at this on their own and can see it, can you describe like some good core basic exercises that they could be able to do?
Sure. Okay, so what they can do is they can start by facing the TRX, grabbing the handles, having your elbows at your sides, and then just literally just go down into a squat. Go down a squat. Weight is on the back of your heels. Toes are off the floor when you're doing squats. That's basic. Lunge, same thing. They can hold those handles at the side right in front of them. Drop that back, the left leg, drop that back knee, and bring it up. So that's two basic exercises for lower body. Upper body, you can grab the handles. And again, depending on body weight and how you adjust the body weight, is the closer the person steps to the A-frame, the harder it is. The more of an angle your body is at, the more weight you're gonna pull up. So you can go from standing up straight all the way to almost on the floor. So how that works, okay, so let's just say you want to do a row and work the back. You're going to grab those handles, hands are facing one another, chest height, and just drive those elbows to the back wall and then release. So bend and release, bend and release. Again, always engaging the core at the same time, pulling in that stomach. Bicep curl, elbows are nice and high. You're going to fold those arms in and come out. You can also do a basic push-up by standing away from it, turning around, having those handles in front of you, open palm. I always say open palm because it gives your forearms a rest. And you're basically doing a standing push-up. And again, you can increase the intensity by doing one foot. You can pulse it out. You can go fast. You can do, there are variations for people to do with TRX.
Especially depending on how close or far away they are.
Absolutely, absolutely. Close and far, where they stand with the TRX, that is the most important. And people tweak all the time. You know, you feel the workout and say, oh, this isn't good enough, just take a step in. Oh, this is too much, take a step out, step away.
Okay. Yeah. Do you find this is a good way to introduce people to the basics of body movement before you even get them doing other traditional free weights or things like that?
That's a really good question. I do. I always start, anytime I had a new client, I always started with TRX because it really would teach people the proper form, and then they can go to the floor and do the weights if they want. But I really feel, and I truly believe that TRX and weight training, regular traditional free weights, is a really good marriage because TRX gives, it tweaks those muscles that you may not really get with the free weights, and it's just a really good workout. I just love it. I do.
Yeah, kind of when you notice, if you do, say you're standing on one foot for a long time, you notice all those little muscles that are quivering and moving to balance.
Right.
So is that just like times 100 here because it's the whole body?
Pretty much, yes. Yes, especially if you do back to back, or if you time it, or if you do three sets right in a row, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, those muscles are twitching.
Okay.
Yeah, which is quite fun. For a trainer.
So how did you get into this format?
I was actually personal training with a woman in Michigan, and she was opening up her own studio, and she said, hey, have you ever heard of TRX? And I said, no, what is it? And she's like, well, let's go. And I got certified, and I've been teaching it for 7 years. So it's been great. It's probably my favorite tool. I have one at home that I work out with.
And is it because of its flexibility, its go-to availability, go anywhere, take it with you? Is that your favorite part, or is it how it makes you and your body feel?
It's everything, but mostly how it makes my body feel. And I can only share with you with what one of my old clients said was, she would do weight training all the time, but when she started taking my TRX classes, she said, that's when I started noticing all my muscle definition coming out. And that's exciting. You know, you feel yourself getting stronger. TRX is just a very special tool that I really wish everybody would use, because it is for everybody. It's for young, old, elite, and just starting out. You know, I have another client who was in a bad car accident, and she can't really squat that well. or use her lower body that well, but we started on this and she loves it because she can hang on to it, and we've really brought her along quite a bit with TRX.
And I imagine over the long term it's kinder to your body.
It is, because it's not that heavy pounding that people feel, or at 45 years old, my knees are starting to feel it. So I can modify this, but still get a good workout, yeah.
What would you say to someone who you see kind of walking around this frame, looking at it skeptically? What would you say to encourage them to go ahead and give it a try?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would just say, well, if they are really intimidated, grab somebody if they can on the floor and have them. If not, then maybe jump in a class or just try it. Pick up some handles and just do, you know what? Simple. Squat in a row. Squat and basically just row hands in front of them, hands facing one another, and just kind of do a row. It's a very simple, not intimidating, no burpees in it. You can do burpees in it. You can do some crazy stuff with it. But for just walking up, just grab the handles and just start rowing. And that's kind of what gets people going a little bit. So...
Well, Kathy, thanks so much for showing me the ropes, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. I hope when anybody sees these, they won't be intimidated. I know they are intimidating. And then also, a lot of people kind of go online and look at different TRX. And here at the North Shore, we do have a poster up on the back wall that shows some basic TRX moves that they can kind of check out and see for themselves. But just pick it up and just start doing. It's good.
I know I'll be giving it more of a try, so hopefully others will too.
I hope so. I hope to see you.
Kathy Quattracci is a personal trainer, group exercise, and TRX certified instructor. She talked with Leg Effect Audrey Nowakowski as part of our monthly Fit for You segment.
Coming up after a break, Radio Chipstone visits the Museum of Wisconsin Art's exhibit of children's clothes, which were designed by Milwaukeean Florence Eisman. It comes your way next on Leg Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Earlier this month, we learned about the Roddus Collection, one of four exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art dedicated to Wisconsin fashion. Three of those four shows focus on adult fashion, but the fourth exhibition looks at the legacy of an influential Milwaukee designer of high-end children's clothing, Florence Eisman.
Eisman started her iconic company in 1945. By 1955, she'd won a prestigious Neiman Marcus Fashion Award for her designs that are credited for creating the look of the modern child. The company is still very much in business.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Sarah Carter, who's the curator and director of research for the Chipstone Foundation, tells contributor Jennifer Fields about creating the retrospective exhibit, Florence Eisman, Designing Childhood for the American Century.
Most of the exhibition projects that we work on, you start in a library, or you start in an archive. In this case, we started in the factory. So we were quite fortunate that Florence Eisman LLC actually has kept hundreds of garments throughout most of their company history. So we were able to go through those garments and begin to make sense of them. They're not sorted at this point as a traditional archive would, because the company is so interested in history that those garments continue to be used as design inspiration today. They've also saved a number of really amazing scrapbooks from the company's history that helped us. Then we also took a trip to Mount Mary, which has a really excellent fashion collection. And we were able to look at a number of early pieces, early Florence Eisman pieces in their collection that have been donated to Mount Mary. So with those two collections as our starting point, we began to piece together a chronology, and we began to look for key themes that we could pull out of those garments that could help us tell some interesting stories. And that's how we began to think about this post-war periodization as being important. And we began to think about a number of different themes that could help us really begin to tell the story of Florence Eisman. Because even though we've written a whole catalog on this topic, the story is still just beginning to unfold. And there are more stories that any one of these garments could tell us.
So then you look at this as a living exhibit. This is something that you will continue to, in some shape or form, add to, work on, continue to build up and flesh out those narratives.
One of the things that's been so exciting with this project is that it very much is a living exhibit. People come into the gallery, they might hear me give a lecture, and they immediately want to tell me their stories. And they want to share their objects, and they want to share their family photographs that have every one of their kids and grandkids wearing a Florence Eisenman dress. I've had people telling me stories like, you know, in the 1950s, I wanted to dress my daughter in beautiful Florence Eisenman clothes because I was a working mom, and that let everyone know she was well taken care of. I've had other people say they love the factory sales so much that they would bring a little piece of string with them so that they could see exactly how big their child was in comparison to the garments there for sale, to make sure they could get a garment that their child could wear this year so they wouldn't have to wait 2 more years for him to wear the cute little shortalls. These objects really resonate with people because they connect to their lives, to their families' lives, and they also connect to Milwaukee. I mean, this is a Milwaukee company.
This really does pull you in a sense that not only does it pull you in through the eyes, your eyes as an adult, but it then takes you back to that childhood period. And if you're lucky enough to have had one, it would have been most likely tied to a special event. Your Easter dress, your Christmas dress, your family photo dress.
I have that same experience here. I mean, there are dresses I look at and I think of my next door neighbor who used to wear dresses like that, and we would go to teddy bear teas every year around Christmas. I mean, it's a very emotional, visceral connection to these objects that even though I can study them as a scholar, as a historian, I also have to connect to them as a person who have memories of my own childhood. I connect to them as a mother, thinking about how difficult it was to try to get my son into a Florence Eisenman garment. These kinds of garments invite that personal connection, which is something that, as a curator who often works on other materials, I'm always trying to develop and to create, to have someone connect to what we're displaying. But when you're dealing with children's clothing, and especially fantastic children's clothing, like the work that Florence Eisenman has been creating for 70 years now, it just happens. Those connections are just made. And as curators and designers, we've been able to facilitate those connections in some interesting ways, hopefully.
What I liked about it, Sarah, is that I know you gave a lecture downstairs before we did this interview, and there were a number of women there. But when they came up here, while they may have been sitting in separate seats across the room from each other, we had to wait to do interviews because it was so loud in here. The cacophony, the stories, the connections that were made. I don't know that I've ever seen that sort of interaction in one exhibit ever before.
There was a real palpable excitement. And I think part of that comes from this realization that the things that these women experienced is the stuff of history, and it's culturally important, and they are participants in these historical patterns, and they have stories that we want to hear and that are valuable.
And particularly in a time where motherhood, when you're taking women who were out of the workforce or who were in the workforce during the World War II, bring them out of that workforce, there were women that continued to work and they faced judgments about working. Right. And this may have been a time period where you not only had the everyday stress of being a mom and being part of a family, but now you're facing these external judgments about how well you do your job.
And what's so powerful for me in terms of talking to many women about these garments is they give them a way to talk about some of those pressures. And whether that pressure is getting the perfect garment for your child, or for some women, they even talked about making Florence Eisenman clothes themselves, buying the fabrics and creating garments so that their children could have these garments as well. But thinking about how these garments might suggest both the pleasures and the pressures of motherhood, and how those things so often go together. And also thinking about parents' roles in trying to create what some scholars have talked about as a sense of wondrous innocence for your children or childhood, creating a feeling of wonder. And that wonder could be having all of your children wearing matching clothes and having this very special moment on a family vacation or at the holidays where you're creating a beautiful image that you will treasure for years. Or that wonder could be having your child wear a dress that might have a whole range of funny aprons or pinafores that they could wear, like some of the really wonderful doll-shaped pinafores in the exhibition. But creating that sense of wonder is in some ways both a pleasure and a pressure of motherhood. And these clothes can help you begin to think about that complexity.
Talk to me about the design and the look of this exhibition.
We were quite fortunate to be able to work with Brent Budsberg, who's an amazing exhibition designer. And we took various historical cues to help us design different parts of the exhibition here at MOA. And what we're looking at here in this section is a room that is inspired by a presentation drawing made by Chicago architect and designer Henry P. Glass. And he created this for a Chicago fabric company, and it's a presentation design for a company selling tiny little children's clothes on forms in these wonderful, strange, amoeba-shaped shadow boxes, and with this great mid-century inspired furniture, and with this really interesting ceiling installation. And so what we were thinking about in selecting this as a design source is that we wanted visitors to feel like they were actually there in the 40s when Lawrence Eisenman and Florence Eisenman started selling these garments at Marshall Fields in Chicago. And there are several other moments like that throughout the exhibition where we're not just putting the clothes on display with labels, but we're trying to create an experience that invokes memories, that connects to the garments, that allows visitors to see them not just as works of art on the wall, but as garments that existed in a specific historical context. I think the women in this space felt welcomed in, and they felt that they could look closely and that they had something valuable to say about the garments on display, which of course they do. And these kinds of design interventions invite that sort of conversation because we're really thinking about their experience. We're thinking about what it feels like to be in this space, and we are trying to make it feel comfortable, interesting. We're trying to transport them to another world, which is part of what museums do. They take you out of your daily life and they bring you somewhere else. And in this case, we are trying to invite visitors into an historical moment when they can look at these garments, think about these garments, connect, remember, and then think about how the things that they might have worn, that their children might have worn, or their grandchildren might have worn, or their aunt or niece or nephew might have worn, can connect them to some pretty big themes in American cultural history and American art history.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. That project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts. And that is the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.